Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. In looking at today's front page, we see police, black leaders in Dubuque talk about reforms, nurses share tales from front lines, but we'll start with virus catches up with manufacturing sector. Local manufacturers are feeling an ongoing significant impact from the COVID-19 pandemic by Jeff Montgomery. In mid-March, when the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic hit home in the U.S., the economic impact was both sudden and sweeping. Restaurants and retail stores were mandated to shut their doors, prompting a cascade of job cuts in those industries. Meanwhile, efforts to shift priorities and prepare for the virus compelled healthcare establishments to cancel elective surgeries and lay off a substantial portion of their staffs. By comparison, the manufacturing industry had not yet seen the worst of its downturn. Mark Schwab, the owner of Lancaster Machine and Tool, recalled that his company had a backlog of orders that kept it busy through March and much of April. But the sense of normalcy eventually ended. "It hit us about a month after it hit everybody else," Schwab said. "Eventually, it catches up to you. Our customers saw a decrease in their orders, so they pulled back, and it affected our orders as well." In recent months, multiple companies have announced major layoffs or outright closures. At John Deere Dubuque Works, indefinite layoffs that took effect in May and June collectively impacted more than 260 production workers. Meanwhile, the permanent closure of the Flexsteel Industries manufacturing facility in Dubuque resulted in the loss of 213 jobs, and about 125 jobs were lost due to closure of Hollander Sleep Products in Maquoketa. Numbers obtained by Greater Dubuque Development Corp. show that 2,514 Dubuque County manufacturing employees have filed initial unemployment claims since March 15th. Of the claims, 1,015 were filed in the 6 weeks stretching from March 15th to April 25th. The remaining 1,499 were filed in the 12 weeks that followed. Other hard-hit industries have observed opposite trends. In the accommodation and food services sector, there were 1,440 new unemployment claims during that initial 6 week stretch ending April 25th. In addition, there were 1,172 initial claims in the retail trade sector and 1,780 in healthcare and social assistance during that time. Over those first 6 weeks, the accommodation and food services sector led the county in new unemployment claims twice, while the healthcare and social assistance sector occupied the top spot four times. The manufacturing industry has led the county in new unemployment claims in 11 of the 12 most recent weeks. Rick Dickinson, president and CEO of Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, believes the differing results reflect the ways in which the industries were affected by recent events. Hospitals, retail stores, and restaurants, on one hand, were affected by mandated government shutdowns, experiencing a massive initial hit, but they have since started rebounding. In the manufacturing sector, which did not face the same kinds of mandated shutdowns, the wave of job cuts was caused by the pandemic itself. "It has impacted orders, and it has impacted the supply chain," Dickinson said. "Even if a manufacturer did have the orders coming in, they may not be able to get the parts they need, or they may not have the workforce they need." At Lancaster Machine and Tool, employees create machines and tools that help other manufacturers build their products. As a result, its business often reflects the broader ups and downs of the manufacturing industry as a whole. Schwab said many manufacturers have been forced to scale back or shut down due to health-related concerns. Demand for end products also has swayed manufacturing activity. For instance, the auto industry has slowed considerably, while the food processing business has remained strong. As orders have declined, Schwab has had to adjust staffing accordingly. We did not lay anybody off, he said. We cut back our hours and tried to get by that way. Nicholas Hockenberry, director of Jackson County Economic Alliance, has noticed a similar trend among manufacturers in his neck of the woods. Prior to this, the big problem for employers was finding people, he said. That's a big reason why these companies are hesitant to let go of a portion of their workforce. They are concerned about replacing them when the economy rebounds. In Jackson County, manufacturing firms have followed a trajectory similar to those in Dubuque County, experiencing only minor layoffs in the early stages of the spring and seeing those cutbacks escalate in the late spring and early summer. Hockenberry noted that the fortunes of large manufacturers often trickle down to the smaller ones who rely on them. We have a couple of manufacturing firms who supply to larger ones like John Deere and Caterpillar, Hockenberry said. The decrease in demand has hit them particularly hard. Local economic development officials, however, say there are some positive signs emerging over time. In both Dubuque and Jackson counties, the rate of layoffs and furloughs in the manufacturing industry has begun to subside. Even so, Hockenberry acknowledged the fate of local manufacturers remains firmly intertwined with the uncertainty surrounding the virus. We are pleased to hear that many of them are finding ways to weather the storm, he said. The question is, how long of a storm can we expect? Next from the front page, nurses share tales from front lines. Dubuque healthcare workers provide critical assistance to communities that have been hit hard by the coronavirus. By Eric Hogstrom. Cheyenne Stearman admits she was scared when she embarked on her journey across Iowa to deliver care to critically ill COVID-19 patients. It was scary being 5 hours away and being on my own, she said. On May 17th, Dubuque County had 264 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Across the state, Woodbury County was in the midst of a coronavirus outbreak already confirmed in 2,215 people, and that had hospitalized 84. May 17th also was the day Stearman, a 27-year-old registered nurse at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, left home for a 2-week stint caring for critically ill patients at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center on the front line of Woodbury County's outbreak. They were being hit hard in Sioux City, she said. Step up and answer the call. Tracy Larson, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer for Mercy One Siouxland, said her hospital was blessed to be supported by Stearman during the height of Woodbury County's COVID-19 surge. She and our healthcare colleagues did exactly what we do during times like these. Step up and answer the call of our community, Larson wrote in an email to the Telegraph Herald. Woodbury County had experienced a surge of infections in the spring tied to an outbreak at a Tyson Foods beef processing plant nearby in Nebraska. Stearman said that, in mid-May, patient census numbers at Mercy One Dubuque were relatively low, so she volunteered to be dispatched to a relative hotspot. She chose to embark on the deployment despite some personal misgivings, including leaving her fiancé, Charlie Saul, and their 6-year-old son. I didn't want to leave my family for 2 weeks, she said. I hadn't been away from my son for that long. A graduate of Maquoketa High School and Northeast Iowa Community College, Stearman is a member of the resource pool of nurses in Dubuque. She works in units as needed. At that time, in mid-May, I hadn't had any COVID patients, she said. Her first day in Sioux City provided instant experience in dealing with the novel coronavirus pandemic. They had 3 whole floors of COVID patients, Stearman said. Mercy One Siouxland had coronavirus patients in an intensive care unit, a second unit with critically ill patients, and a third unit of not as seriously ill patients. Here in Dubuque, we just had a couple of rooms with COVID patients, she said. Stearman mostly worked with those critically ill but not admitted into the intensive care unit. It was hard, she said. Here in Dubuque, we try to have a nurse with a couple of COVID patients at a time. In Sioux City, individual nurses had 6 COVID patients at a time that were all in critical condition. The level of personal protective equipment that Stearman wore reflected the highly contagious nature of the coronavirus. I had to wear PPE for 12 hours straight. It was exhausting, she said. The first time I put on an N95 mask, it was kind of claustrophobic. It hurts your face after 30 minutes. Stearman wore double gloves, 2 masks, hairnets, protective eyewear, and booties during her 12-hour shifts. She worked a total of 6 such shifts during her Sioux City deployment. It was very stressful, she said. I always had to give myself a little pep talk before going in, but Mercy One Siouxland made us feel so appreciated, and that helped a lot. Never seen people get this ill this quickly. Stearman was one of a handful of Dubuque nurses to assist in COVID hotspot locations. 2 Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital nurses, Greg Simpson and Natalie Fangman, cared for patients in the intensive care unit at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo during a coronavirus surge in Black Hawk County in April. Skyrocketing COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in the county were linked to an outbreak at a Tyson Foods pork processing plant in Waterloo. Black Hawk County went from 35 COVID-19 cases on April 8th to 1,644 cases on April 28th. Simpson and Fangman cared for patients in Waterloo during the last 2 weeks of April. It was busy in their ICU there, Simpson said. They had a lot of the people from the meatpacking outbreaks at the time. Simpson worked 2 weeks at Allen, first 12-hour night shifts and then 12 hours during the day. He saw how devastating this disease is and how rapidly people can decline, he said. I've never seen people get this ill this quickly. Simpson said that in his quarter century of critical care nursing, he has seen ill patients take a turn for the worse over several hours. With COVID patients, they were taking a turn for the worse in a matter of minutes, he said. This virus is just so terrible. Fangman has worked at Findlay for 3 years. In a piece on Unity Point Health's website, she said she welcomed the opportunity to help at Allen. I wanted to find a place that I could help in any way possible, Fangman said, telling my friends to be safe. Stearman was the only Mercy One Dubuque nurse dispatched to a hotspot. She was relieved to come home when her deployment had ended. I was so happy, she said. I learned so much, and when our numbers of hospitalized COVID-19 patients in Dubuque County started increasing, I felt so prepared. Stearman also arrived home with a message she often repeats. I'm telling my friends to be safe, wash your hands, and wear a mask, she said. This pandemic is real. And finally from the front page, police and black leaders in Dubuque talk about reforms. Racial disparity in arrests is among the topics discussed during a 2-day Black Lives Matter Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion work session by Thomas J. Barton. Black men and women were arrested on average at rates disproportionate to their numbers within the city of Dubuque over the past 5 years. When we look at our raw data, we know there are racial disparities in our arrests, Dubuque Police Chief Mark Delsing told city council members this week during the second day of a 2-day Black Lives Matter Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion work session in advance of an annual council goal-setting session next month, and it's something that we have to continue to delve into on an annual basis. We know crime and arrests, therefore, follow poverty. And we know what the poverty situation is in our minority communities in Dubuque. In 2018, the most recent year for which data was available, 54% of black residents in Dubuque County lived below the poverty line, compared to 20.8% nationally. That is also more than 5 times the poverty rate for white residents in Dubuque County, which stood at 9.5% in 2018, according to census data shared with council members. Dulsing said the department conducts monthly arrest audits in which the department's professional standards office reviews reports, body camera, and dash cam footage from arrests of 5 minority and 5 white individuals arrested on the same charges. Officers also are sent questionnaires about the arrests to identify potentially problematic behavior and provide a form of intervention and reflection. Dulsing emphasized that a majority of Dubuque police calls for services and arrests are in direct response to complaints from other people and not officer-initiated. So, we also see parallels between arrest and victimization rates, he said. Black victimization rate in Dubuque is 21.9%, which is significantly higher than Dubuque's black population, with a higher percentage of that being black women, which might contribute to disparities in black arrests. That said, a reimagining of policing likely will need to occur as cities and communities debate police reforms following local and national protests and unrest since the death of George Floyd, Dulsing said. On Monday, local black leaders urged city leaders to shift resources from policing to programs that help black and Hispanic residents. Among their recommendations is to remove school resource officers in Dubuque Community Schools or curtail their ability to arrest students outside of when weapons are brought to school. Dulsing said while law enforcement is part of a school resource officer's job, the main focus is on building relationships with students and staff. The officers are involved in restorative justice and mediation with students to resolve problems before possible juvenile court referrals. I agree that we should continue to look for alternatives to charges, especially with misdemeanor charges, he said, but we can't ignore other crimes and let them escalate to a time when it becomes a weapons charge. There's a lot of discretion, diversion, and alternate remedies already in place for crimes in schools. The Dubuque branch of the NAACP also requested an overhaul of the city's Police Relations Committee to increase its oversight. Established in 1993 through a memorandum of understanding with the NAACP in response to accusations of racism, the committee hears complaints about police misconduct regarding civil rights or discrimination. The committee can recommend training, policy changes, or mediate between involved parties. It does not make disciplinary decisions, referrals, or recommendations. Committee Chairman Mikkel Jackson, who is also vice president of the Dubuque branch of the NAACP, said it would like for the committee to release reports on the state of police complaints, to review all internal affairs investigations, and to recommend to the police chief to approve or reject the findings. Dulsing previously said he would not be opposed to granting additional civilian oversight, but that it would need to come, quote, with a tremendous amount of training, end quote, on police use of force. The NAACP also called for the department to reduce the amount of lethal rounds available to officers while increasing the use of less lethal rounds. Over the past 30-plus years, Dubuque police officers have used lethal force by firing a gun at an individual only 3 times, in 1986, 1996, and 2009. In 2 of those situations, people armed with knives came after police officers, Dulsing said, and in 1 situation, a subject shot an officer. In all 3 situations, no lives were lost. While we were very fortunate to have such gaps in this category, there are situations every year where lethal force could have been a legitimate and legal option that our officers have been able to de-escalate based on their training. Over the past 5 years, the department has averaged 3,400 arrests per year. Of those, force was needed in 6% of arrests, according to Dulsing. From today's almanac, today is Thursday, July 30th, the 212th day of 2020. There are 154 days left in the year. On this date, In 1619, the first representative assembly in America convened in Jamestown in the Virginia colony. In 1916, German saboteurs blew up a munitions plant on an island near Jersey City, New Jersey, killing about a dozen people. In 1945, the Portland-class heavy cruiser USS Indianapolis, having just delivered components of the atomic bomb to Tinian in the Mariana Islands, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. Only 317 of nearly 1,200 men survived. In 1956, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed a measure making "In God We Trust" the national motto, replacing "E Pluribus Unum," which means "out of many, one." From the Dubuque and Tri-State page, active cases fall to 799 in Dubuque County. State of Iowa reports 9 additional fatalities related to COVID-19. Wisconsin's death toll rises by 5, while Illinois sees an increase of 18. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Wednesday's developments included 27 additional cases of COVID-19 were confirmed in Dubuque County in the 24-hour span that ended at 5 p.m. Wednesday. The county's total stood at 1,405 at that time. No additional related deaths were reported during that span. A total of 211 additional tests were completed in the 24-hour stretch, meaning the county had a positivity rate of 12.8% during that time. The number of Dubuque County residents confirmed to have COVID-19 who have recovered jumped by 50 to 580 on Wednesday. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered from the total number of confirmed cases, there were 799 active cases in the county as of 5 p.m. Wednesday. That was 23 fewer than 24 hours earlier. 2 more cases in Jones County and 1 more case in Delaware County were reported from 5 p.m. Tuesday to 5 p.m. Wednesday. That pushed the county's totals to 114 and 80, respectively. Meanwhile, after 21 consecutive days in which at least one new case was reported, Jackson County had its second consecutive 24-hour period without a new case. 23 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized as of Tuesday, according to the most recent state data. There also were 2 residents each from Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties. There were no Clayton County residents with the coronavirus hospitalized. Statewide, 506 additional cases were reported during the 24-hour span, pushing the total to 43,285. 9 additional related deaths were reported, so that toll rose to 848. In Wisconsin, Grant County had a jump of 11 new cases Wednesday, pushing its total to 313. Crawford County's count climbed to 55, while Iowa and Lafayette counties each had 1 new case, pushing their tallies to 59 and 103, respectively. Statewide, 870 more cases were reported Wednesday. The Wisconsin total rose to 51,049. 5 additional related deaths also were recorded, so that toll stood at 911. In Illinois, Joe Davies County reported 2 additional confirmed cases Wednesday. The county's total rose to 106. Statewide, 1,393 new cases and 18 additional related deaths were reported. The state's totals moved to 175,124 cases and 7,462 deaths. Next, Platteville Council mulls mask requirements by Bennett Goldstein. Alarmed by a spike in COVID-19 cases, Platteville Common Council members are considering mandating the wearing of face masks in public spaces. The ordinance could apply to any form of public transportation or building open to the public, including city facilities and private businesses. Council members this week instructed staff to draft an ordinance along with an alternative, non-binding resolution that only encourages the wearing of masks. Council members, at least four of whom were receptive to a mandate, will discuss both options at an upcoming meeting. "A mask is about you not infecting someone else," said Council President Barb Doss. "I would really like to believe that we would have enough respect for other people to wear a mask. That being said, I don't see that." The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that people wear face coverings to prevent the spread of COVID-19, noting that when adopted universally in communities, all people gain protection. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services considers Grant County's COVID-19 activity level high. The county has confirmed an average of 6 new COVID-19 cases daily over a 14-day period that ended on Tuesday. More than 20 states have adopted some mask requirements. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has expressed interest in implementing a statewide mandate, but said he is hesitant to do so following the Wisconsin Supreme Court's striking of his stay-at-home order in May. To fill the vacuum, Wisconsin municipalities have enacted their own. Wisconsin statute provides local governments with broad authority to enact ordinances to protect the health and safety of residents during a state of emergency, which is in effect in Platteville through October 15th. Platteville Council members examined the City of Whitewater's ordinance, which requires the wearing of face masks inside a public or privately owned structure that is accessible to the public, excluding residences. To enforce the order, police can issue municipal citations with fines ranging from $10 to $150. Those with medical conditions, younger than 5 years of age, or whose religion prohibits them from wearing a face covering also are exempt. Council member Robin Klein said the tide of public opinion toward masks is changing, particularly as a growing list of retailers, including Blaine's, Farm and Fleet, CVS, Menards, Target, Walgreens, and Walmart, mandate their customers wear them. "We are required to wear shoes and shirts in public, and I think it's reasonable to extend that to a mask in such times," she added. Council member Isaac Shanley questioned whether the city would incur legal fees if an ordinance is challenged in court, while council member Kathy Kopp worried it might incite conflicts within the community. "What about the people who physically cannot wear a mask?" she said. "How are they identified so they are not singled out or approached?" Next, opening of Southwest Arterial pushed back. The opening of Dubuque's Southwest Arterial has been pushed back. The four-lane highway connecting US 20 at Siple Road to US 61-151 near Tamarack Business Park will open on September 1st, according to Bob Schiesel, the City of Dubuque's assistant city engineer. He said city staff and officials with the Iowa Department of Transportation met with contractors on site Wednesday. "We discussed the schedule and the target opening, and we decided to adjust the opening to September 1," Schiesel said. The opening had been expected during the first week of August, but Schiesel said work remains on the roadway's middle interchange, located between North Cascade and English Mill Roads. Construction on the $160 million project began in 2016. And finally, man posing as MediaCom employee talked way into residents, Dubuque police say. Dubuque police remind residents not to allow unknown people into their homes after a man posing as a MediaCom employee talked his way into a residence on Wednesday. Police said the man went door to door, saying he worked for MediaCom and offering new rates for cable TV. The individual convinced the resident to allow him inside to review a recent cable bill to compare prices and asked for personal information, stated the police in an online warning. "Please remember not to allow unknown people into your home and never give your personal information." You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, July 30th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Kenneth G. Ken Brown, age 85, of Dubuque, passed away peacefully at 5:28 p.m. on Sunday, July 26th, at his home, surrounded by his loving family. To celebrate Ken's life, family and friends may visit from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. on Friday, July 31st, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Due to COVID-19 concerns, the family asks that anyone attending please wear a mask. To honor Ken's life, funeral services will be held immediately following the visitation at 11:30 a.m. at Holy Spirit Parish, Sacred Heart Church, 2215 Windsor Avenue, with Reverend Stephen M. Garner officiating. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Ken was born on November 2, 1934, in Dubuque, son of King and Lena Rubner Brown. Ken was a lifelong resident of Dubuque. At age 16, Ken went to work to help support his family, starting a Farley and Letcher for 12 years until the plant was closed. He then devoted 34 years to Flex Steel Industries until his well-earned retirement in 1997. He was united in marriage to the love of his life, Felita Wurzer, on June 25, 1955, at the Church of the Nativity in Dubuque. They were very excited to have celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary earlier this year. Ken was an excellent handyman as well as a talented woodworker who in his free time created several beautiful pieces for family and friends. Ken enjoyed being outdoors, spending lots of time hunting, fishing, and gardening. He also enjoyed watching the squirrels, rabbits, and birds that would frequent his yard. Ken loved to travel out west, where he could enjoy the Rocky Mountains, and also took the family on trips to Yellowstone National Park. There was never a doubt that Ken's family was the most important aspect of his life. Spending time with Felita, the kids, and the grandkids brought him great joy and happiness. We are heartbroken at losing our wonderful husband, dad, grandpa, and great-grandpa in our daily lives. He was truly one of a kind, and we will miss him deeply. Ken's family would like to thank the nurses and staff of Hospice of Dubuque, especially Jennifer and Amy, for all of their wonderful care of Ken. They truly are angels on earth. Memorials will be accepted by the family and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001. Attention, Kenneth Brown family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. Robert H. Bobby Soppy, 68, of Dubuque, passed away on July 27th at Manor Care. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, with Reverend Steve Garner officiating, and military honors by the United States Army, Iowa National Guard. Family and friends may gather after 9:30 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home until time of service. Private family burial will take place at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Robert was born on March 9, 1952, in Savannah, Illinois, the son of Irene Felton and Robert Soppy. He was a U.S. Army veteran serving during the Vietnam War. He graduated from Dubuque Senior High School and worked as a self-employed roofer and cider. Bobby was the best bartender in Dubuque and had everyone in stitches with his wonderful sense of humor. The family would like to thank the nurses and staff at Manor Care for all the wonderful care they gave to Bobby. Barbara A. McDonald, 81, of Dubuque, passed away at her home on Tuesday, July 28th. Visitation will be from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. today at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 Kennedy Road, Dubuque, where there will be a prayer service at 7 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 31st, at Church of the Resurrection, 4300 Asbury Road, and will be live-streamed on the Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home Facebook page. Their church requires masks for all attendees. Reverend Philip Gibbs will officiate. Burial will be in Linwood Cemetery immediately following the service. Barb was born May 31, 1939, in Dubuque, daughter of George and Doris Bile Peel. She and James B. McDonald, Jr. were married on May 13, 1961, at St. Columbkill's Catholic Church. He passed away on July 8, 2013. Barb worked at St. Vincent de Paul for 22 years, retiring in 2006. She enjoyed gardening, puzzles, genealogy, games, and spending time with her family and friends. Everyone enjoyed her fried chicken, potato salad, and caramel bars. She was a member of Resurrection Catholic Church. In lieu of flowers, a Barbara A. McDonald Memorial Fund has been established. Thanks to Dr. Leobo, his nurse Trish, and her loving son Jim for helping her through her entire journey. Also, a special thanks to Hospice of Dubuque, especially Jan, Brittany, and Stephanie, and all our family and friends who helped in so many ways. Condolences and memories may be shared at www.egelhoffsiegertcasper.com. Gregory L. Werrell, 70, of Mount Hope, Wisconsin, died on Monday, July 27th. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. today and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st, at Larson Family Funeral Home in Fenimore. Funeral services will take place at 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Burial will be in Prairie Cemetery in Fenimore. Edna Winninger, 68, of Lansing, died on Tuesday, July 28th, at her home. Visitation will take place from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday, August 3rd, at Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Lansing. A private family mass will be held with interment at a later date. Christine M. Werner Hunt, 54, of Naples, died on December 19th in the care of Aval Francis Georgeson Hospice House. A committal service will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, August 1st, in Greenwood Cemetery in Galena, Illinois. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Dorothy Wandling, 90, of Walk On, died on Tuesday, July 28th. A private graveside service will be held at Oakland Cemetery in Walk On. Martin Grau Funeral Home in Walk On is handling arrangements. Karen Sue Rep, 72, of Dubuque, passed away on July 27th at her home, surrounded by her loving family. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Friday, July 31st, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where a funeral service will occur at 4 p.m. with Pastor Jacob Bartlett officiating. Karen was born on July 14, 1948, in Davenport, the daughter of Robert and Helen Shirley Rankins. She married Craig C. Rep on June 29, 1991, in Dubuque. Karen was the owner and manager of the Avalon Supper Club and Breezy's Cafe. Karen was an energetic person full of life and loved everyone she came in contact with. Her ability to cook was displayed often at the Avalon Supper Club and Breezy's Cafe that she and Craig owned and operated for over 10 years. The love of her family was very important to Karen, especially her children and grandchildren. Karen believed in God, prayer, and angels as a testimony to her spiritual life. A Karen S. Rep Memorial Fund has been established in care of her husband, Craig Rep, 435 Gilmore Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001. The family would like to thank Dr. Eric Engelman and staff at Medical Associates Oncology Department, Hospice of Dubuque, especially Sarah, Amy, and Jessica. Virginia Gage, 84, of Wadena, Iowa, died on Saturday, July 25th at Maple Crest Manor in Fayette. Visitation will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, August 2nd, at Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in West Union. A private mass of Christian burial will be held with interment at a later date. Mary C. Kelleher, 66, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, July 28th. A private family burial will be held at a later date in East Dubuque Cemetery. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Funeral services. Most funeral homes and churches are practicing social distancing guidelines recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Contact specific locations for more information. Richard W. Conrad, Earlville, Iowa. Services 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Earlville. Visitation from 3 to 7 p.m. today at Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Earlville. Donald L. Cornish of Dubuque. Services 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Visitation from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 Kennedy Road. Sister Dolores M. Kramer, BVM, Carmel Drive, Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial at 10:45 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Marion Hall Chapel. Ralph L. Rowling of Dubuque. Services at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. today at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home, 3860 Asbury Road. William M. Schneider of Savannah, Illinois. Celebration of Life from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, August 2nd at La Jones Funeral Home, Mount Carroll, Illinois. Carol Ann Smith of Dubuque. Graveside services at 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Holy Family New Melray Cemetery. Denver C. Trom Jr. of Mount Carroll, Illinois. Celebration of Life at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 8th at First Evangelical Lutheran Church, Mount Carroll. Visitation from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday at the church. And now from the sports page, from Jaws of Defeat. Mustangs score twice in the seventh to extend their season. By Jim Leitner, Dateline Des Moines. Andrew Heary hoped his stellar high school baseball career wouldn't come to an end on a fly ball with the tying and winning runs on base. It looked like it might until the baseball god smiled on him Wednesday night. Henry's misplayed fly ball to left field dropped just inside the left field line, allowing two runs to score and giving Dubuque Hempstead an improbable 7-6 victory over Iowa City High in front of 815 fans in the Iowa Class 4A State Quarterfinals at Principal Park. The Mustangs, 16-1, advanced to Friday's semifinal against Ankeny or Pleasant Valley. City High bowed out at 11-9. I really didn't want my last career high school at bat to be an out, but they kind of helped me out. It got down, and we scored two runs to win the game, so I'll take it, said Henry, who was credited with a hit on the ball that dropped between three fielders. When I was down at first base, I just saw the third baseman and left fielder kind of collide, and it hit the tip of their glove, and I was like, oh boy. I've never been through anything like that before, but it's a great feeling. The most important thing is we get to come back here Friday and play again. Michael Garrett drew a one-out walk to start the seventh-inning rally, and Zach Sabers took a two-out hit batsman. Gable Mitchell came on in relief of Reese Hayden to face Henry. That last inning was certainly pretty hairy, but we found a way to get it done, Hempstead coach Jeff Rapp said. I do feel bad for City High, because they pecked away and had us beat. But I've been on the other side of games like this one, so I know how they feel. I think I'm going to sleep good tonight, though, because, I tell you what, my blood pressure had to be about 400 that last inning. City High opened the scoring in the top of the first inning without the benefit of a hit. Garrett Bormann led off the game with a four-pitch walk, stole second base, moved up to third on Carter Season's ground out to second base, and scored on Mitchell's ground out to shortstop. But, as has been the case all season, the Mustangs had an immediate response in the bottom half of the inning when they batted around. Kellen Strohmeyer reached on a leadoff hit batsman, and Henry drew a one-out walk to set the table for right fielder Logan Rundy. Batting from his stronger side against left-hander Cade Obermueller, the switch-hitting Rundy pulled a double to the left field corner to drive in the first run. After Devin Udaly walked to load the bases, Max Pins punched a sacrifice fly to right center to give Hempstead the lead 2-1. Obermueller walked Terry Schaber and Dane Schoppe to force in a third run before reliever Hayden got number 9 hitter Garrett to fly out to deep center to end the inning with the bases still loaded. Rundy, who had Hempstead's only hit in the first inning, flashed the leather in the top of the second to end a 1-2-3 top of the second. He dove to snag Jacob Means liner to the right center field gap. The Mustangs kept their foot on the gas in the second inning to stretch their lead to 5-1. Sabres, Rundy, this time batting from the left side, and Udaly singled to load the bases with two outs. Pins laced a two-run double into the left field corner to make it 5-1, and City High avoided two more runs when shortstop Mitchell made a stellar play on a Schaber bullet and threw a strike to first baseman Means for the third out of the inning. It felt really good to get an early lead on them because it took a little of the pressure off us, Pins said. I would have liked to keep going and score a few more because City High is a good team and they keep battling back. But I felt pretty confident that we'd still be able to pull it out. We've been in situations like that before and came through. Hempstead threatened again in the third when Strohmeyer hit a towering 400-foot triple off the center field wall with two outs and Sabres walked. But Hayden got Henry to ground out and end the inning. Henry allowed only two base runners on a walk and an error and struck out four in four innings of work, but did not factor into the decision. Rapp went to the bullpen in the fifth to keep Henry's pitch count under 65 so he could throw in the tournament this weekend. I felt really good, Henry said. I wanted to go a little more, but it was a decision to save my arm and help the team. And that's the most important thing right now. Rapp credited Hayden for shutting the door for four innings, and he tipped his hat to the Little Hawks for making him question the decision. We definitely thought we would score three or four more, but he shut us down, Rapp said. In retrospect, it was probably a bad move on our part to go to the bullpen because Andrew was really kind of starting to settle in there. Reliever Brock Booth retired the first two batters he faced, but City High pulled within 5-2 after Hayden, Egan, Smith, and Bormann collected the Little Hawks' first three hits of the game. An inning later, with Sabres on the mound, Mitchell and Colby Schnobelin singled to start a Little Hawks rally. Back-to-back RBI groundouts by Joey Buska and Obermueller pulled City High within 5-4. Smith led off the top of the seventh with a base hit up the middle against Hempstead's third reliever, Rundy, and Bormann bunted him to second. Seaton followed with an infield chopper to the hole at shortstop, and Smith scored when Strohmeyer's throw handcuffed Henry at first base. Schnobelin singled up the middle later in the frame, but a perfect relay from Henry to catcher Sabres cut down Seaton at the plate. After another error loaded the bases, Obermueller gave City High a 6-5 lead with a bases-loaded walk. It doesn't seem real that we pulled this one out, Strohmeyer said. It really looked like that fly ball would be caught. It's crazy. But everything's crazy these days. Credit to City High, because they fought and fought. We had a couple of errors that helped them out, and we really can't have that. It wasn't that we stopped hitting. We were still hitting line drives, but they were right at people. Next, Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week, Cole Smith of Dubuque Senior. Smith ends junior year on a high note. Rams shortstop goes 7-for-8 in the last doubleheader of the season, by Shannon Mum. Although he didn't expect them to be the final games of his junior baseball season, Cole Smith went out with a bang. The Dubuque senior shortstop went 7-for-8 at the plate in a doubleheader against Dubuque Wallert and concluded the year with a .528 batting average before the season abruptly ended with the notice of a positive COVID-19 test. This week's Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week led the conference in hitting and was named a unanimous All-Mississippi Valley Conference selection. Cole is one of those guys who works hard at everything he does and puts a lot of work into his craft, senior baseball coach Andrew Reese said. He demands a lot of himself and his teammates. Smith ended the season with 4 doubles, 1 triple, and 14 RBIs while drawing 10 walks in 16 games. Cole had a pretty special season for us, Reese said. He was our 2-hitter and did a great job of putting the ball in play. Cole, who moved from second base to the shortstop position this season, earned second-team all-conference honors as a sophomore. I pretty much play baseball nonstop, and prior to the whole COVID thing, I was going to take the year off of track to put in more work to focus on baseball, Cole said. I was able to put on about 25 pounds over the last year by working out, and I can tell it really helped my game. It's great to see that hard work does pay off. Smith fielded at a .942 clip with just 4 errors in 69 chances. Cole did a tremendous job for us defensively, Reese said. He was voted as one of our team captains, and he has evolved into a solid all-around player. Cole, who has been playing baseball for the majority of his life, said he was disappointed that the team did not get the opportunity to make a playoff run. We had to shut down right before the tournament began, and it was upsetting that we didn't have any control over how our season ended, he said. I feel bad for the seniors, and it's hard that it ended so quickly. We will never know what could have been. Cole plans on pursuing a collegiate baseball career and has already gotten back on the field as a part of the Key West semi-pro team. He will then play fall ball with a travel team based out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I really love the game, and it's something I've been doing for as long as I can remember, he said. It's a big deal to me, and I'm excited to see how much more I can improve over the next year. And finally in sports, under prep football, MVC to play 7-game slate. Hempstead, Western Dubuque to meet in week 2. Rams will host the Mustangs in week 3, by Tim O'Neill. The Mississippi Valley Conference announced its intentions for its Class 4A football programs this fall. The conference's 12 teams that compete in Class 4A will play a 7-game conference schedule and will name divisional champions at the end of the season, the league announced Wednesday. The schedule also includes an intriguing non-conference game, and there could be a Thursday night football game in the works. Hempstead is scheduled to open the season at home on August 28th against Linmar in a divisional crossover game. The Mustangs are then scheduled to play at Western Dubuque, the reigning Class 3A state champions, on September 4th to complete their non-conference slate. Hempstead opens conference play with a visit to city rival Dubuque Senior on September 11th before a road trip to play Iowa City West on September 18th. The Mustangs then host Cedar Rapids Kennedy September 25th and Cedar Rapids Jefferson October 2nd in consecutive weeks before finishing the regular season at Waterloo West on October 9th. Senior returns to the Unidome to open the season with a crossover game against Cedar Falls on August 28th. The Rams host Cedar Rapids Prairie in their final non-division game on September 4th. After the city showdown, Senior hosts Cedar Rapids Kennedy on September 18th before traveling to Waterloo West on September 25th. Senior is scheduled to host Iowa City West on October 2nd and close the regular season on October 9th at Cedar Rapids Jefferson. Both Senior and Hempstead are scheduled to play at Dalzell on October 2nd, meaning one game will likely move to Thursday, October 1st. Western Dubuque, Dubuque-Wallert, Cedar Rapids Xavier, and Waterloo East also compete in the MVC, but are classified as 3A programs and will play district schedules assigned by the Iowa High School Athletic Association. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, July 30th, 2020. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thanks for listening, and be safe.